Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of May. Sydney Blumenthal is with us for the first half hour of this program, and then we'll be speaking with a professor from Rutgers University who served on the staffs of all kinds of senators, Walter Mondale, Birch Bayh, Frank Church, and others. Sydney Blumenthal, a senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, a longtime journalist. He now is Washington Bureau Chief for Salon.com, a regular columnist for The Guardian. And over a number of years, he's written for The New Republic, The Washington Post, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker. He's the author of The Clinton Wars, also The Permanent Campaign, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, Pledging Allegiance, The Last Campaign of the Cold War, and How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime. He has strong Midwestern roots. We like to salute those from the Midwest, born in Chicago. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Sydney Blumenthal. We're going to talk all about all kinds of issues. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Sydney Blumenthal, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We had Congressman David Obie on yesterday. He's a hard guy to book, but we had a really interesting conversation with him. And he said that the key factor in terms of an exit strategy for Iraq is that we're going to have Democratic unity on this issue, whatever direction they decide to go. He's working out some kind of deal to cut the funding by July of this year. Two questions. What is a good exit strategy? And do you see the Democrats unified on an exit strategy?
I think the Democrats in the Congress will be unified. I don't know about Democratic activists. They're all over the map.
Yeah.
I think that what will happen is that the idea of a timeline will be separated from funding, and benchmarks will be tied to the funding. And that the funding bill will have a short leash, which means it'll there'll be a funding for several months, and then it'll come up again in September. What's interesting is that John Boehner, who is the Republican leader in the House, said that there's a lack of patience on the Republican side, and that in September they want to revisit it again. I think the Republicans see themselves in dire straits politically because of the issue. And so I think that really the crunch comes in September.
Mm-hmm. And what about these benchmarks, Sydney? What do we mean by benchmarks? Who's going to determine what they are?
Well, the Congress will determine what goals can be met by the Iraqi government in assuming responsibility for doing what President Bush said, which is, as they stand up, we'll stand down. Can the Iraqi army assume certain duties and so on? Can the government move towards a political solution and become more inclusive? I think the benchmarks cannot be met.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there's an effective Iraqi government. No one I know who's expert believes that. So we're looking at a continuing crisis down the road.
Mm-hmm.
The Iraqi government cannot do what it can't meet any goals.
So we're giving until September also to see if this surge is working?
Well, the surge is absurd on its face because while the presence of increased numbers of U.S. troops might create some security in some neighborhoods of Baghdad, it doesn't secure a political solution elsewhere, mm-hmm. nor does it solve the problem of other violence or sectarian warfare in the country. It's just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, what the surge is doing is, in the short run, creating more U.S. casualties. Now, the administration will say that is the price that must be paid in order to, in the long run, get peace and security and create the basis of a political solution. But no one really believes that.
Why do you think the president vetoed this bill?
I think ultimately he vetoed the bill because he cannot admit error. He believes, according to everybody who's met with him, members of Congress I've talked to who met with him, that he's correct, that this is a matter of willpower on his part, and that if he stays the course, this will work out because it has to work out. So ultimately, it may be because he's delusional.
Mm-hmm. And what do you, this is kind of simplistic, but it is what you hear from people who are concerned about our leaving, that if you think we got chaos now, just wait until we pull out.
I don't know. No one knows. People say that. I think the situation may be something like it is now. For all we know, the Sunni tribesmen who are the insurgents may wind up killing the, 1,000 or so people associated with Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, with whom they are engaged in some hostilities. It may be that the way to deal with that small grouping that calls itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq is to withdraw and let the Sunnis kill them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows is right. Let's talk a little bit more about the Republican response to this. Your take is that if we don't see some kind of different direction here, withdrawal or an improvement in this situation, that the Republicans are going to change their strategy somewhat because they're just going to be done in by the next election?
The Republicans are facing a wipeout. They know that. They may know nothing about Iraq, but they certainly know a lot about domestic politics in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what their own situation is, and it is dire. I don't know how long they can hang on here, standing behind Bush. The American political factor always remains a central factor in sustaining any war. Anyone who is aware of U.S. history going back to the Civil War, to the where there was a lot of impatience with Lincoln's policy, and there were moments when it looked as though he might even be beaten politically.
Right.
To Vietnam, where our military certainly learned a lesson that they didn't want to be in the situation of being blamed for failure, and people pointed fingers because there was, I think there was a long-term political support for the Vietnam War, actually. The problem was it was a struggle that couldn't be won on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And, now we have a situation where Bush is trying to pursue a strategy apart from domestic U.S. support. Now, the idea that you can do this or you should do this ignores the very character of American democracy. It doesn't mean you vote on wars, every single day,
right,
if you're in the middle of them. However, you do need public support, and you need it for a whole host of reasons,
mm-hmm,
including the fact that you don't want your military's reputation damaged within your own country,
mm-hmm,
and certainly the military feels that way. But Bush is heedless of all of that. Now, the Republicans are not. They're increasingly aware that they are the ones who are going to pay the price for this. And the real benchmark and the real timeline has to do with domestic U.S. politics.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you watched the Republican presidential campaign. Did you see any of those guys set themselves apart, give us a different strategy for Iraq?
The problem that the Republican candidates for president have is that still about 80% of Republican voters support Bush. So they are trapped.
Mm.
To the extent that they separate themselves from Bush, they damage their prospects to win the Republican nomination.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent, though, that they tie themselves to Bush, they damage themselves for any general election. It's a complete quandary for the Republicans, and they're in a no exit situation. Speaking of no exits, they're in a no exit situation.
Yeah. Let's talk about George Tenet. You wrote about him last week in one of your columns. You've read his book. You call it a sketchy book, Devastating in Patches. Glaringly misleading about many decisive events in which he played an important role. What are those?
Well, among others, Tenet believed the fabrications of the Iraqi exile agent named Curveball, who claimed that Saddam was building, you know, had WMD and was seeking, you know, had these mobile labs running around. The head of clandestine operations for the CIA in Europe, Tyler Drumheller, had reported the conclusions of German intelligence that this curveball, this Iraqi exile, was totally unreliable and shouldn't be listened to. He had reported this before Tenet had advised Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, to deliver his speech before the UN Security Council, making what he considered to be an ironclad case of the intelligence about Saddam's possession of WMD and links to al-Qaeda, none of which turned out to be true. The truth is, Tenet had been informed before he told Powell to put that in his speech by Tyler Drumheller. In his book, he's disingenuous about this. That's only one of the many things that he's disingenuous about. Tenet is a classic staffer who seeks to please, and he sought to please George Bush.
We're going to take phone calls. Cindy Blumenthal is our guest, and our number is 800-486-8655. Of course, Iraq is still top of mind, but there you can go anywhere you want with what's going on politically. He served as senior advisor to President Clinton. He is now Washington Bureau Chief of Salon.com and a regular columnist for The Guardian. A couple lines are open. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We sure want to thank you before we start taking phone calls for all of your contributions to our spring membership drive. It ended early because you stepped up to the plate and gave some support to this station. So we had donations of $275,000 with 2,100 members pledging and welcoming 676 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. So it was a short drive. And we thank you very much. All right, let's go to phone calls for Sidney Blumenthal, starting with Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Mr. Blumenthal, I appreciate you taking the time. An apocalyptic president, it looks like we have. And, you know, being a Christian, some of these people really scare me. And, you know, they're just their ideas. I mean, three of these guys in the debate raised their hands when they were asked if they believed in evolution or not, and it just blew me away. I wanted to get your thoughts on how the Democrats are being set up to fail in Iraq. We're just letting this tease along, because no matter when we pull out of there, no matter what, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there is going to be chaos when we leave. And Republicans know it. Republicans also know that they're not going to take the White House this coming election. And I believe they're just stringing this along so that when a Democrat is in and we do eventually pull out and chaos follows, fingers are going to be pointing at the Democrats. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's not unreasonable to think that what Bush is setting up is that when he leaves office, there'll be about 150,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq, and that the problem will be left to the next president. Well, Bush can claim, at least you know, in his own mind, that you know, he tried to win. So, if the next president doesn't pursue his strategy and instead begins an exit strategy, that then Republicans can accuse that person of being a defeatist, and that there's an American defeat that's been caused by the next president, not by Bush. This is a this is a classic stab in the back theory. It's very poisonous, and it's now being inserted into our future politics by the Bush strategy.
And yet, he, on some level, he's got to see that the American people are, if you took polls right now, you'd have a Democrat win the presidency, you'd lose seats in the House and lose seats in the Senate. You know, at some point, he's a Republican, isn't he? And he's a loyal Republican, and he would hate to see his party lose even more power.
It's hard to see that Bush cares at all about the future of his party or about anybody who succeeds him, Republican or Democrat, as president. I think it looks as though Bush only cares about Bush. He looks completely self-involved here. His vision doesn't extend beyond himself. I don't think that there's any action that he's taking that shows any regard for his own party.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Let's go to Ron from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. The military think tanks and strategists surely have a tremendous power to script the strategies of the administration. To what degree do you think this is happening and has been happening? There's a new book out, coming out, the New York Times says, it's called Brothers, about the Kennedy administration and how Kennedys might have actually been afraid of a mutiny in the military. I think all administrations really are going to be the products of military strategizing. To what degree is Bush and his administration part of a long-term policy?
I think Bush has ignored all those military think tanks, institutes that you mentioned. He's ignored them studiously. He's ignored the advice of the senior military. I know a lot of these people at these places and talked to them for years, and he's ignored their advice. He certainly ignored the advice of Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki at the beginning of the planning for the invasion of Iraq in terms of the size of the force that would be used to invade the country, and he's consistently not listened to the military. I think that what's going on right now, the key thing is that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates may be at odds with Vice President Dick Cheney and perhaps even the President. Gates is clearly listening to the senior military, which would be the first time in this administration that anyone is doing so. It means that Gates is a rational man, and having a rational person in this situation could create a great deal of abrasion and friction with Cheney and Bush. And that's something to watch. In that, Gates is his relations with senior military, as I understand it, is pretty good right now. Very much unlike Rumsfeld, who was a bully.
Thanks for the call. Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I didn't tell your screener, because the remark came after I talked to him, but your guest's remark about there's going to be chaos, well, I don't know what you call 150 civilians getting blown up day after day, much less the rather nasty count of our boys and girls over there. That seems pretty damn chaotic to me. And I think the longer we stay there, every day we stay there, makes it worse. The press coverage is part of the problem in this country. There's the old-fashioned numbers game where when hundreds of thousands of people gather in Washington to shake the timbers on the House of Government, you get reports from the New York Times to NPR, tens of thousands, and sometimes even thousands. And another number that's really, like, never used is that right now we've got about 250,000 fighters in Iraq, as far as I can tell, if you add our armed forces with the mercenaries. So if we had a real look at the tremendous amount of grassroots organizing that's going on right now in this country and being ignored by the mainstream press, it's no wonder Bush can be delusionary.
Let's talk a little bit more. He's got a point with this, and you brought this up, too, this real lack of domestic U.S. support for this effort. We had a sea change in Congress during the midterms because of the policy here. How do the American people figure into this, and why do you imagine there isn't more, even more outrage on the part of the American public? They don't like this strategy.
Well, I think the American people changed the Congress.
Right.
In great part because of their feelings about the Iraq War. And now the Congress is trying to do what it can to change the policy. It's a very hard thing to do for a Congress.
Mm.
The Congress is not well suited to doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not designed to conduct foreign policy. When I say to conduct foreign policy. The margins in the Senate, especially, are not great. It's one vote.
Yeah.
So this is a very hard thing to do in this system. And yet, so the Democrats have a lot of difficult navigation, and they also have to deal with pressure from their base.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very difficult political situation, but that the point that the Democrats have to keep in mind is that it is Bush who is accountable, that this is his war, and that it's the Republicans who must vote. The issues need to be framed, the bills need to be framed in such a way so that the onus is put on the Republicans, and they are beginning to feel it, as you can see through Boehner's statement.
Sure. Forgive me if I've missed this, but have you thrown your support behind any particular guy or gal on the Democratic side for the presidency?
Personally, I'm for Hillary. Hillary's a Senator Clinton's. I worked closely with her, and
mm-hmm.
She's a friend of mine. I think she's capable, effective, respected in the world, would make an excellent president. She's, as far as I'm concerned, the most qualified person of anybody running to be president. What I'm concerned about more than anything, as somebody who has worked in a White House and understands the executive branch and the Congress, is that, and is a Democrat, which I am, obviously, is that these are going to be a very difficult few years in office, and it's going to require somebody who understands how to do this, who knows the players in the world, who has knowledge of how to operate in the Congress. We have, as Democrats, been here before under much less trying circumstances, with people who were politically experienced to a degree, but not as great as Senator Clinton. And we saw what happened with Jimmy Carter, and frankly, what happened in the first 2 years of Bill Clinton. And we lost control. Lost the White House under Carter, lost control of Congress, and we can lose it again. On the other hand, if we do this right and govern well, I believe we could have two terms with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president and get a lot done.
Mm-hmm. So
and that's my view about this matter, and that's why I support Hillary.
Yeah. So just one final question from me. We'll let you go. You don't buy into this that she's not electable?
Hillary is leading all of the Republican candidates right now. Her favorability with the American people in the polls that are released today in the CNN USA Today poll show her favorabilities as high as anybody. I think the dynamics of politics as they develop will make her more electable if she wins the nomination and becomes the Democratic candidate. I think the Republicans all bear the burden of Bush, and that they can't escape from his policies. That's what this campaign will be all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sidney Blumenthal, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sidney Blumenthal, our guest, the first part of the program, served as senior advisor to President Bill Clinton. He is now Washington bureau chief for Salon.com and also a regular columnist for The Guardian. To talk about George Tenet, an exit strategy for Iraq, the Republican presidential candidates, the Republicans, and how they're responding to Iraq. And then just in the last few minutes, his support for Senator Clinton for the Democratic nomination. We're going to continue, same kind of topic, just different guests, the next part of our program, and continue to welcome your phone calls. We have Professor Ross Baker joining us momentarily, a professor of political science at Rutgers University. He has written a number of books, including American Government, The House and the Senate, Friend and Foe in the U.S. Senate, The Afro-American, back in 1970. He's a regular contributor to the editorial pages of the Los Angeles Times and Newsday, and his commentaries have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Tribune, and the Boston Globe. He's heard on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. And he has a real interesting background. He served on the staffs of Senators Walter Mondale, Birch Bayh, Frank Church, also as a consultant to the Democratic Caucus of the U.S. House of Representatives. In the year 2000, he served as a senior advisor to Senator Chuck Hagel from Nebraska and also Patrick Leahy from Vermont. He is a member of the adjunct faculty of the Government Affairs Institute of Georgetown University. And we continue welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Baker, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you on the air again.
Thanks.
All right, let's talk about who's going to fashion and who's going to buy into an exit strategy from Iraq. What can the Democrats get the president to sign? What do the Republicans who are growing disaffected with this war need to have happen? What should happen here?
Well, this debate has evolved in a very interesting way, Kathleen. I mean, clearly the target dates for withdrawal that were in both the House and Senate bills, although they were different dates, were basically of the same piece, which was basically having a kind of a hard deadline for the withdrawal of troops. Now, what's happened is that rather than have that kind of approach, what they're doing is they're kind of parceling out the money in installments to the administration, so that this of course satisfies the concerns of people who are afraid the troops wouldn't get money if the Democrats in Congress kept sending back the same $125 billion appropriations bill with targets attached to it, and the president kept vetoing it. They would develop a kind of infinite cycle of vetoes and failed attempts to override, and the money would just never get out there.
Mm-hmm.
So what apparently they've decided to do, although not everybody's on board yet, is to parcel out the money to authorize or to appropriate an amount of money that would keep the military going until September, but to give it in two installments, one in July, and then sort of assess how things are going, and then September. Now, why September? It's taken on a kind of almost a sort of numerological importance. Perhaps it's because 9/11 took place in September, and there's a kind of cosmic symmetry to it. The president, I think, mentioned at one point September as a time to sit back and assess. General Petraeus also used September as a kind of benchmark, a date for assessing progress of the surge. So what I think we're going to see is something that the president will sign because it doesn't have deadlines on it, but at the same time, the money will be given out in a much stingier and a much more controlled way by Congress.
I see. So then when it comes up for more money in September, then if what benchmarks aren't met, the Congress could say no more money?
They would be in a much stronger position.
Huh.
Say to the president, this is a... this is a date that we've agreed on, that you have to demonstrate progress. At the very least, it will get the president to provide Congress a detailed report on the effects of the surge. The assumption, of course, is that what the president gives Congress will be an honest and accurate assessment of,
right,
of the progress. But I think that's the idea. At the very least, it represents a ratcheting up of the accountability of the White House.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you, I can't remember the last time I didn't wake up and have my morning coffee listening to National Public Radio News and hearing day by day by day by day by day about car bombings. And it seems to me as though that's one of the benchmarks here, that you wouldn't hear that kind of incessant news. And these are huge numbers of people who are dying every single day. I would assume that's one of the benchmarks, but what are the signs of progress that everybody needs to see here?
Well, I think one of the things that the multinational force has been very hopeful about is Anbar Province, which, of course, was the original toxic spot on the map for most of the 4 years of the war. And it's a complex situation. I don't think outsiders understand it very well, but essentially what's happened is apparently the Sunni sheikhs have had a disagreement with al-Qaeda in Iraq. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with the same kind of problem the Taliban ran into in Afghanistan, which was, although these are religious Muslims, they don't want a kind of theocratic state with the strict imposition of Sharia, the Muslim law. There are other personal disagreements as well, but the other thing is that the Sunnis have come to regard the Americans as their protectors. So on the one hand, some of the most violent acts come from the Sunni community. On the other hand, you have a substantial portion of the Sunni community believing that the only hope that they have for protection against the majority Shia is the U.S. Army.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And what about the al-Qaeda presence in Iraq? How large is it, Professor Baker? And who are these people?
Well, it's hard to know. There probably was no significant al-Qaeda presence in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He simply wouldn't have tolerated it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, by ridding Iraq of Saddam Hussein, we created, in a sense, a much more auspicious recruiting ground for al-Qaeda. Most of al-Qaeda's people in Iraq, as I understand it, are not Iraqis. That al-Qaeda has been a kind of lodestone for disaffected Muslims from all over the Muslim world, including Kosovars, Egyptians, Tunisians, Moroccans, Indonesians. They come from everywhere, and apparently the word gets around that there's a recruiting station somewhere in Iraq, and they know where to go.
Hmm.
The borders are not well guarded. They can enter through any number of points.
Mm-hmm. So if we decide, if things aren't going very well come September and this war is not funded anymore, it seems to me as one of the reasons that it's hard to stop this is because there doesn't seem to be any way to come up with a happy ending here, that indeed there's chaos now, indeed there would be chaos if we left. It's just nothing settles very well.
No, it really doesn't. What seems to be the most problematic and, in fact, the most depressing spectacle of all is that basically Iraqis now see their own country as the venue for a zero-sum game in which Shiites win, Sunnis lose, Sunnis win, Shiites lose. It's a situation that really doesn't allow for a lot of optimism. If what the Sunnis want is the eternal presence of the American troops to protect them from the Shiite majority, I think that they're, unfortunately, placing their bet on a very, very slow horse.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. George from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I called yesterday and tried to get on with the representative you had at the same time.
David Obey.
Mm-hmm. And but I wanted our Congress to look into the fact that we are in the military, have been training Air Force troops in infantry training. 500 shipped out from a Wisconsin base a week and a half ago. And they've taken extensive military training in IED and infantry and urban assault. And I asked the E-7 why they were doing that. He says, our army is devastated in Iraq, and they need help.
Okay. Professor Baker?
Yeah, it's reminiscent of the naval battalions. When the British really were stretched thin in World War One, they began using Royal Navy recruits as infantry, and they had these so-called naval battalions. It's the sign of an army that is stretched to the breaking point.
Mm.
There are now, of course, recruiting has been made much more lenient in terms of the conditions under which someone might be rejected. I have one of my students is an Army captain who had a company in which he was a recruiter from Pennsylvania had sent him a woman who was a heroin addict.
Oh, geez.
And what happened was that, he said, we had no facilities to treat a heroin addict. And the Army is not a therapeutic institution. She was a real problem. She would wander off the base. She would go into town to score heroin.
Oh, gee.
And so what happened was that he pleaded with the Army to get her out. And the problem was that they needed her as a witness because they were lodging charges against the recruiting officer who brought her in to begin with.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was really a mess. And I suspect that you're going to find problems like this all over.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Robert from Madison. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. Your guest's credentials are fabulous. I really appreciate them. But I guess the Democrats' installment approach to get out of Iraq, I think, makes some sense. Here's some money. You don't meet the benchmarks. You publicize that. And then, of course, the inevitable of not meeting the benchmarks will occur, and eventually we'll get out. But the bigger picture is and the ones you hear about the people who say we should stay there is what's going to happen to this country when we leave? And that's the thing that I believe there's going to be no dialogue on. And we have people saying that dire consequences are going to have. McCain, the other day on his show, said dire consequences are going to happen here. I certainly don't believe that.
Oh, you mean they're going to come here? Line?
Those are the dire consequences.
Uh-huh.
But here's really what's going to happen. What's going to happen, as your guest has pointed out, you will have probably more intense fighting. It'll certainly be more brutal. And, yes, more people will get killed. And that's true, and that's inevitable. But the point is it'll come to a stabilized situation. Sunni-based countries are not going to let a Shiite-based country take over the Iraq. They'll both fight the last Iraq if they have to. But that really won't happen because they will come to some sort of peaceful coexistence. They used to be in peaceful coexistence. There's no reason to think they won't. Once they come to that peaceful coexistence, they'll look at these intruders from the outside, the Al-Qaeda that have come from other Arabic countries, and say, get the heck out of our country. That's what's going to happen. Now, all these dire consequences is wrong. People are not going to let the oil not be sold, so all of these other countries will make sure that Iraq is finally contained. And what bothers me the most about all these appropriation bills is that if you believe these dire consequences, that the whole region is going to go up in flames, my goodness, why isn't Saudi Arabia, Syria, and all of those other countries in Egypt saying, listen, here's $500 billion, United States, to help keep the region stabilized. I guess we have as much to lose in it if it becomes unstabilized.
Hmm.
So I hope to God that that's what's going on in real smart think tanks as far as how this thing is going to end.
All right, I need to hold you there. We have a lot of people in line. Professor Baker.
Well, I think your guest brings up a very good point. And frankly, I think that the leaders of the Sunni countries that are concerned about the Persians, as they refer to the Shiites, I think they can't see beyond the end of their own noses. I think they're happy to have the United States in there. But I think they're puzzled because, in a sense, our presence in Iraq, our toppling of Saddam Hussein, has benefited Iran. I mean, Iran has been the real winner from the very beginning. And I think that these friends of ours in the Arab world, the Egyptians, the Saudis, and people in the Gulf states and so on, are kind of frankly puzzled as to why the United States would pursue a policy that was so beneficial to Iran, which is the country that everybody seems to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one that poses potentially a nuclear threat. It is certainly expressed in the most extravagant terms of hostility toward Israel and so on. But I mean, I just think it's they're perfectly happy to see the United States bear the burden. But I think at the same time, they're wondering why the effect of the American presence there is so beneficial to the country that everybody acknowledges is a big problem.
Professor Ross Baker is our guest. We're going to take more phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, heavily involved in politics. He served on the staffs of Senators Walter Mondale, Birch Bayh, Frank Church, a consultant to the Democratic Caucus of the U.S. House of Representatives. In the year 2000, senior advisor to Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican from Nebraska, and Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have one line open. If you want to take it, it is yours. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the author of Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives, David Sloan Wilson will be with us, a distinguished professor of biology and anthropology at Binghamton University. We'll be talking about Darwin and about evolution. And about why species behave as they do, from beetles that devour their own young to bees that function as a collective brain to dogs that are smarter in some respects than our closest ape relatives. So that's coming up, second hour. Professor Baker is with us. Until then, we go back to phone calls, and let's go to Ellen from Madison. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I want to thank you once again for just having a great program and getting a wide variety of guests and opinions. I want to identify myself as a moderate Republican. I have both voted Democratic presidential candidates as well as Republican presidential candidates. I did vote for George Bush, and I think my comment about Professor Baker's approach is that it has a strong component of being pretty unequivocal in the way he characterizes both the Republican Party and Bush and all the people surrounding Bush. And as a voter who's pretty moderate, I yearn for a more equivocal representation of the complexities of that both parties face, the failures of both parties, the over-politicking as well as polarizing that goes on. And I just don't think that these extreme comments, like using words like always and never and, you know, as if there are no thoughtful Republicans or no, you know, that unreasonable minds have been the only ones that have been involved in this. That isn't helpful. As a matter of fact, I think it's really turning off the electorate. I know it turns me off. And what's really helpful for me is to hear both Republicans and Democrats who have been entrenched in the political process, much like the professor has on the Democratic side, to acknowledge that there are good minds on both sides of this, and it is very complex, and both sides are guilty of politicking that isn't always beneficial. And that's really about all I have to say.
All right. Thanks, Ellen. And just, I don't know if you were confused, we had a different guest on the first half hour who had some very pointed comments, not so much about Republicans, he did somewhat, but very pointed comments about the Bush administration and the president in particular. So don't mix up the guests here. I think that Professor Baker has been pretty reasonable about this. You want to take on her comments, Professor Baker?
I just wanted to point out to Ellen that one of the senators that I worked for was Chuck Hagel,
right,
Nebraska Republican. And I consider myself neither a Democrat nor a Republican, and I sort of depends on what side of the bed I get out of in the morning. But I can understand her concern, and I think that, you know, she's certainly giving voice to a feeling I think that lots of people have, and that is that certainly in recent years that the rhetoric has gotten really overheated and over the top. And I think, you know, you kind of look at what Congress is and what it has been, and of course you see, you know, really two armed camps. I think the election changed that to some extent, at least as far as the Democrats are concerned. The Democrats were successful in recruiting candidates in areas that had not been traditional Democratic stronghold. And while it's true that the vast bulk of Democrats in the House of Representatives and the Senate would certainly answer to the description of liberal, the Democrats are a much more diverse crew than they were prior to the 2006 election. But I mean, I think that Ellen's concern is well taken, and I think that there is a tendency sometimes to use hyperbole and to just to get attention. I think that the loudest and most extravagant claims are the ones that are likely to get the media coverage.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Blumenthal's comments were directed mostly toward the president, and he did say that he believed that this president had absolutely, it just had no regard for the Republican Party, really no regard as to whether or not he could help their fortunes in the next election. I'd like for you to comment on that and also comment on people like John Boehner, who has been very much a Bush supporter, saying a couple days ago, by the time we get to September, October, members are going to want to know how well this is working, and if it isn't, what is Plan B? I mean, you can sense this dissatisfaction with the administration among Republicans.
Right. I think that, you know, the president simply no longer sees himself in a community of fate with congressional Republicans. As of the 20th of January 2009, he's gone. He's going, you know, back to Crawford, Texas. Whereas Republicans are going to have to run in the 2008 election, senators, a number of them have already indicated tremendous anxiety about the prospects of the 2008 election,
right,
if the war goes on as it has been. And I think that you know, what's happened is they've come to a parting of the ways, that the president, you know, simply feels he can hand the war over to his successor, whereas the Republican members of the House and Senate have to face the electorate in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jose from Chicago next. Hi, Jose.
It's Hossein, actually.
Pardon?
It's Hossein. It's not Jose.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I'm a Shia Muslim myself.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering if the U.S. is ready to disengage themselves from its friends in the Middle East, meaning Saudi Arabia has a history of oppressing the minority, so-called minority Shias. And Bahrain has the same thing. Qatar has the same thing. Yemen has the same thing. Egypt has a problem. Jordan has a problem. Every one of these countries is oppressing Shias. Recorded facts. I mean, these are, I'm a Shia Muslim, so I know that the communities in these countries are being oppressed. Is the U.S. ready to engage those countries and saying, you should stop this? I mean, Iraq is the same thing. Iraq has been the same thing since 1969, when Saddam came in power. I mean, is the U.S. ready to confront these countries, saying, let's be realistic, you are not providing these Shias with human rights, and you are talking, and at the same time, you are trying to liberate Iraq. I mean, how does that work?
Professor Baker.
Well, I would be very skeptical that the United States would ever get involved in attempting to, let's say, dictate to President Mubarak about the treatment of the Shia in Egypt, or to any of the leaders of any of the Gulf state countries. I just don't think that any American diplomat would attempt to do that. That would be considered very much domestic politics in those individual countries. While acknowledging the fact that this kind of oppression may well exist, as Hussein suggests, I seriously doubt that the United States would want to use its influence to try to bring up the issue, or even try to improve the situation of the Shiite minorities in these countries.
Let's go one more phone call. Joe from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could just address the overarching issue of Democratic appeal. I'm confused by it. Maybe you could explain it. With constant complaining, the constant friction, the constant lack of nobleness in their speech and in their intentions, whereas at least President Bush, wrong or right, at least he appeals to the nobleness in us of defending freedom, of defending the defenseless, whether it's abortion or whether it's in Iraq.
But nobody likes him. His poll numbers are down the tube, Joe.
But what hope is there with the complaints and the friction and the lack of nobleness on the Democratic side?
All right. Do the American people see the Democratic Party as a party of hope? Professor Baker.
Do they see the Democratic Party as the party of hope? I don't know that I'd express it that way. I think that they, when they're dissatisfied with the administration in the two-party system, they're the only people to turn to. They're the standby equipment. They're the fire extinguisher on the wall. And I don't think they see it particularly in terms of nobility. I mean, I think it would be a wonderful measure to use to hold our elected representatives to our noblest professions as a nation. But I just don't think that most Americans do that. I think they see things much more pragmatically, if somewhat less majestically.
Mm. You're a great guest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank
Kathy.
You. Professor Ross Baker, he's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, author of a number of books. He is a regular commentator on National Public Radio and has served on the staffs of a number of senators and consultants as well to the Democratic Caucus of the U.S. House. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks to everybody for all of your calls. It's about a minute now before 10. We'll have news from National Public Radio, and we'll return and talk about evolution. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.